Hi, I'm Misha Ketchell, editor of The Conversation. For democracy to work, people need to be well informed. That's why we work with academic experts to share their research and explain issues in the news. Everything we do is free to republish, but we need your support. Please donate to The Conversation by going to donate.theconversation.com or following the link in the show notes.
Hello and welcome to the Conversations Politics podcast. I'm Michelle Grattan. Last week, the government released a report into conditions at the Nauru Detention Centre, which showed a dark picture of abuse, including sexual assault and rape and drug dealing. Nauru was reopened by the Labor government, but Labor's voice has been relatively muted in relation to the latest allegations. Today we're joined by Richard Miles, the opposition's spokesman on immigration, to discuss this report, Labor's asylum seeker policy, and the immigration portfolio more widely. Richard Miles, the government has accepted all the various recommendations of the MOS review of conditions on Nauru, including having contract providers overhaul their guidelines. What more should be done?
Well, we believe that the issues that were raised in the MOS review are so serious. We're talking about allegations of sexual assault in relation to people who are within the facility, that it does warrant the Senate having an examination of this, and particularly an examination of the Australian government's role within the facility and also the handling of this issue. The fact of the matter is this has been handled appallingly by the government from the time these allegations were first raised last year right through to the timing of the release of the report this year. And we think all of that needs to be looked at, and we need to have a very clear sense that everything is being done so that people who are in this facility can be treated in a way which provides safe, dignified and humane refuge.
Now, I know you've said some things about this, but nevertheless, Labor hasn't been high profile in response to this report. I don't think there have been any questions, for example, in the House of Representatives. Why is this?
Well, I wouldn't accept that that assessment. We've only had one question time since review was made public. But you know, I was very quick out of the blocks in respect of this. And let's be clear: this review was released in a media sense in the dead of night. This was released on a Friday afternoon, last Friday afternoon, on what that morning had become a very solemn day for our nation. I was very forceful, or at least I tried to be, in respect of our concern about this, because I think this review and the issues that it raises and the conclusions which it draws goes to the very heart of the attitude that this government has towards asylum seekers. That you can have a situation last year where allegations of sexual assault against detainees is raised on the one hand, and on the other there is a concern that some staff of service providers may have been involved in inciting protest. And it is that issue which animates the government rather than the question of the sexual assault of minors, says everything about where this government is at. And it oughtn't to be a hard thing for the government to say that any facility that it funds should provide safe, dignified and humane refuge to the people within it. It never uses that phrase. And quite evidently, so long as there is sexual assault going on within these facilities, that's an obligation which Australia is not meeting. And we're deeply concerned about that.
Now, the allegations about fomenting unrest were suggestions against Save the Children. The report found that there was no case for those allegations. Do you think there should be an apology by the government to the Save the Children organisation?
I certainly think that the government has done the wrong thing by Save the Children, and if there was any dignity in this government, then an apology would be forthcoming. Let's be clear. Without any proper discussion with Save the Children, the government ordered 10 of its staff off Nauru. All of that was then briefed out to newspapers in Australia before, again, there had been a proper conversation with Save the Children about the government's concerns. And the handling of all of this is then slammed by the very review that the government sets up in response. I mean, this is a condemnation of the way in which the government has handled this issue. And I come back to the fact that it was that which concerned the government, not, it seems, the whole question of the sexual assault of people who are within this government's funded facility. And it says everything about this government's priorities. And I absolutely think there needs to be an apology on the part of the government. But I think the government really needs to, it has lost its moral compass in respect of this issue when it places the inciting of a protest as a higher priority than the question of sexual assault of minors. And it's for all those reasons that we are keen to put in place a Senate inquiry to examine all of this.
Now, Labor reopened that centre. Does that mean that Labor shares some of the blame for what's happened?
There's difficult reading in the Moss Review, I believe, for any government which has been a party to Nauru. Be really clear about that. And we, you know, use similar language in respect of the report that was released by Professor Triggs. We don't shy away from that. We actually want to look at these reviews, look at the lessons that are learnt, and work out how we can go about our business better. But that's in stark contrast to this government who, in relation to Professor Triggs or in relation to Save the Children, their immediate instinct is to go out and shoot the messenger. But I'd make this point as well. One of the findings of the Moss Review is that the circumstance of the people inside the Nauru detention facility still living in tents 18 months after this government was elected goes to the heart of the question of security for the detainees, and it goes to the heart of the question of privacy. Now, it was our intention when we were in government to complete the construction of the facility on Nauru such that those tented facilities would become hard-walled facilities, which would go a long way to addressing the issues that have been the subject of the Moss Review. The decision not to build hard-walled facilities was an active decision on the part of this government, Minister Morrison, which seems to me to be a very punitive decision based on trying to create some sense of deterrence, which it wouldn't have been anyway. And that is a decision which is an absolute disgrace. So I do think there is a difference between how we would have managed Nauru and how this government has managed Nauru. But what's important now is we learn the lessons from this review and we make sure that we get it right in the future.
Well, indeed, looking to the future, the boats have stopped. Would Labor consider closing offshore centres, Manus, Nauru, when you're getting reports of conditions like these?
It's not about closing Manus and Nauru. Offshore processing, in our view, has played an utterly critical role in ending a human tragedy, which was the enormous loss of life of asylum seekers at sea. And from a place of compassion, it is right to maintain a position which sees, we hope, an end to the loss of life at sea in the future. So I think it would be the wrong step to go down the path of ending offshore processing. But what's important is that whatever facilities we have in place, whatever facilities that Australia is funding, do provide safe, dignified and humane refuge for the people within them. And that's what we need to ensure occurs.
Are you saying that if there wasn't offshore processing, the boats would start again?
I'm saying that offshore processing has been the single most important step taken by any Australian government in bringing an end to the flow of asylum seeker vessels from Java to Christmas Island, no question. We saw a 90% reduction in the flow of asylum seeker vessels from the time the regional resettlement arrangement was put in place in July of 2013, really within a space of 2 months. And that persisted right through until the end of the year, end of 2013, without the current government taking any substantial step in this area. Offshore processing has been utterly critical in seeing an end to the flow of asylum seeker vessels, and it's important that as a policy it's maintained.
Labor's opposing the turnback policy still. Wouldn't it seem more logical to support turnbacks and abolish offshore processing? Wouldn't that be more humane, really?
Well, the first point to make is we're not going to do anything which sees that journey from Java to Christmas Island start up such that we see an end to the loss of we see a loss of life rather. We want to make sure that the end to the loss of life at sea is maintained. Our concern in respect of Termax, one that we have made on numerous occasions, is that if we are to have a sustainable, a durable resolution to this issue, not one which is measured in terms of months, but one which is actually ultimately measured in terms of years and decades, then it's plain common sense that we need to be working hand in glove with the country from which these vessels are coming, Indonesia, our nearest neighbour. Now, the critical issue in respect of Termax is what it does in relation to the levels of cooperation between Australia and Indonesia on this issue. And that is that those levels of cooperation are nowhere near the same now as they were when Labor was in office. And that is a question which the current government has utterly failed to answer.
But nevertheless, the Indonesians do seem to have settled down about the turn back policy. They mightn't like it, but it doesn't seem as much an irritant as it was some time ago.
That proposition isn't clear to me. I mean, you have the current Indonesian president who, in his first utterance as the president about the relationship between Australia and Indonesia, refers to the turn back policy. It's certainly not clear to me that this is a matter which is settled in the context of Australia and Indonesia's bilateral relationship, but in a sense more specifically in the context of Australia and Indonesia's cooperation around this issue. So this is not about I'm seeing this very much through the prism of Australia's national interest and specifically through the prism of making sure that we have a durable resolution to this over the long term. But to have that, we need to be working hand in glove with Indonesia, and the government simply hasn't explained how we will be able to do that in the context of its policy of turning back boats, and so that's our concern. I would add there's also an issue around the safety with which these operations are carried out, and so long as this is all happening under a shroud of secrecy, which it is, it's very difficult to assess that as well.
Let's turn to another subject. The government has recently announced changes to 457 visas for foreign workers, including lowering the language requirements. Where does Labor stand on that?
Well, we believe there is a genuine issue about the exploitation of people who have come to work in Australia under 457 visas, and actually not just 457 visas, but other temporary labour schemes, and that would include both people coming here under working holiday programs, but also people who come here as students. Now, our principal interest here is in the protection of those people who are working in Australia under those visas, and to ensure that they are not being exploited. We do welcome a number of the measures that were announced by the government in response to its independent review of the 457 visa program, which seeks to beef up compliance in respect of 457s. But that would seem to us to vindicate the position that we've taken over a long time, that there is an issue here. And for most of that time, the coalition's been saying there's nothing to see here. Well, actually, I think there is, and it's important that we get that right. So we are very keen to see that there is a proper regime in place around 457s. One of the concerns we have, which I think still indicates the degree to which the government is a bit half-hearted in relation to this, is that the question of labour market testing would appear to be left in limbo by the government's response to its independent review. We think labour market testing is fundamental to any proposition around maintaining the integrity of the 457 program. And you mentioned English language. I mean, the critical thing here is to ensure that people have the language skills, obviously to do their work, but particularly in relation relation to health and safety. If you have people on construction sites or in commercial kitchens, you want to know that people can first of all read the health and safety warnings, but are able to communicate with the people around them in relation to health and safety matters. So that does remain a concern for us.
Just on the labour market testing, could you elaborate a bit about this? And it sounds as though Labor's not open to any negotiation in that area.
Oh, we think labour market testing is really a fundamental component of maintaining the integrity of a 457 regime. In this sense, that if the idea of the 457 regime, and it has an important purpose, is to fill skills gaps within the labour market, well then it stands to reason that there be some process in place which identifies those skills gaps and tests whether in respect of any particular visa, the application under section 457, that they are legitimate visas to be provided. So labour market testing matters. There is a important idea, I think, which has been introduced, which came out of the independent review, which again Labor supports, and that's the establishment of a tripartite body with both representatives of unions, employers, and the government, there to oversee the occupation list around where there are skills gaps and to oversee the 457 program. We think that's a good initiative. It's important that the government commits to it being a fair income tripartite body, but labour market testing is a critical component of this as well.
I should explain to our listeners that the bells you hear in the background are the senators being summoned.
And the very loud clock is one of the however many that we have in this building.
There are very loud clocks in Parliament House. It's quite amazing.
It feels a bit like a Hitchcock movie when you hear late at night.
You get frightened at night. Now, there's a lot of pressure on Labor to start releasing policies. When can people expect some policies in your area? And are there any particular parts of your portfolio that you're examining especially?
Well, we will absolutely release a robust set of policies between now and the election. And I guess in a general sense, one of the lessons that I think can be learnt out of the experience of the coalition is that being lazy in opposition and getting to government without any idea of what you intend to do, and then put in place a whole lot of measures as they did in the last budget without any conversation with the Australian people, is a recipe for disaster. We're not about to make that mistake. And you will see across the board a much more fulsome and rigorous policy development process than what we saw from the last opposition in the lead up to the 2013 election. In respect of our area in particular, I mean, obviously the National Conference is an important step on the way, and that's at the end of July, and we will be making sure that at a headline level it matters are addressed in the platform which goes to National Conference. But we would want to see an attempt to, I think, bring resolution to the very difficult issue of asylum seekers, which has been, I think, a difficult and, can I say, I think quite a corrosive debate within the Australian polity since 2001. We would like to try and bring some resolution to that, but also to shift...
You mean getting people who are here processed and... moving them on or selling them,
I suppose what I mean is this, not in every detail, but in large measure, we had a degree of bipartisanship around the question of people coming to this country who then sought our protection under the UN Refugee Convention. All of that changed in the Howard government's handling of Tampa, where that bipartisanship was utterly fractured. And since then, the truth is that the Conservative parties have seen this as a fruitful area for partisan gain, and have therefore run the debate in that way for that period of time. I think that has been very corrosive for Australia. I think it's been very corrosive for Australia in the context of who we are as a modern multicultural nation. And I think it's essential for the national interest that we get beyond that. Of course, the asylum seeker policy directly affects asylum seekers, but this debate goes beyond that. And there are victims of this debate who are second and third generation Muslim Australians who are not asylum seekers, but when all of this gets inflamed, find that their kids are spat out at school because they don't have Anglo-Celtic names. You know, that's what we need to bring an end to. That's where we need to find resolution. But I think the other thing we should be trying to do is start talking about immigration in terms of the contribution that it makes to our economy and the contribution that it makes to our culture and our society. And that's a discussion that we've not had for a very long time, because everything has been overshadowed by asylum seekers.
Because the whole portfolio area has really been concentrating on the negatives, hasn't it? Concentrating on keeping people out rather than saying, are we inviting enough in, and what sort of people should we be inviting in? Do you think our intake at the moment is about right, or too large, or too small?
No,
this is immigration intake.
I think the immigration intake is about right. It's flexible, and that's right too. It should respond to particular the status of our economy. But I think, you know, there does need to be a conversation about where Australia is going, the role that immigration will play.
Are you a big Australian man, or a not so big Australia?
I'm somebody who seeks to avoid those terms and being put in those pigeonholes. But I would make this point. I think that the perception of that debate, I actually think, does vary dramatically on where you come from within Australia. You speak to people who come from parts of Sydney, and there is definitely a sense of the world which reflects a congestion of life in Sydney. I come from Geelong, a regional city, where our view is very much that increased population equals increased economic activity equals more jobs. And that is the kind of experience which has informed my attitude to this. It is related, but I very much see that what this century ought to be about for our nation is the building of regional Australia, in the sense that the 20th century was very much about building great cities within Australia, and we have built great cities, but I do think more can be done in respect of regional Australia, and this, there is an intersection between that debate and the question of immigration. But I guess coming back to a point, you know, that you made before, Michelle, Bob Hawke has often said that he thinks the most significant phenomena in terms of the life of the Australian nation, but since European settlement, was that vast wave of immigration to Australia after the Second World War, which happened on a bipartisan basis, supported by the ACTU at the time when he was there, and undertaken largely through the period of the Menzies government. We have just in the last few days been speaking appropriately of the legacy and contribution that Malcolm Fraser made to our nation as the 22nd Prime Minister. And in all of those speeches, one of his great achievements was the bringing of populations from Vietnam and Indochina in the aftermath of those wars to Australia, which is, you know, changed the face of Australia in a completely wonderful way. That's the discussion that it would be great to get back to. That's where I would like to see us, that's how I would like to see us speak about immigration. And it's why it is so important that we get resolution to this issue of asylum seekers, because it has crowded out any discussion around those other aspects of immigration, which are much bigger in a numerical sense, and where I think we need to be talking much more about that in the future.
Richard Miles, thanks for talking with The Conversation today.
Thank you, Michelle.
We'll have another interview for you soon. That's all for today, though. Thanks to my producer, Matt Dawson. I'm Michelle Grattan.
I was saved by God to make America great again. An autocrat loves a crisis. A crisis is the way that they mobilize their base.
While America is under invasion from within, we're under invasion from within.
He's testing the boundaries of what he can get away with.
We should use some of these dangerous cities as training grounds for our military, National Guard, but military.
We've asked six of the world's preeminent scholars how we can measure the make of an autocrat. It's a recipe of sorts, tried and tested by the most infamous leaders in history.
Hugo Chavez in Venezuela.
Vladimir Putin in Russia.
Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler.
Viktor Orban in Hungary.
He's basically bulletproof in terms of criminal prosecution.
Join us from December 29 as we explore Trump, the making of an autocrat, from The Conversation.